5B motion.
Well, but
At which.
Don't you have to file a 35C in which you allege that Mr. Orris was ineffective for the reasons that you've stated?
I think we could do that, but I don't think we're required to file a 35C, and I thought the sum total of this court's decisions are to avoid successive post-conviction type motions at the trial court level, and we have court orders, we have written rationale from the trial court as to what the trial court's rationale is in denying Mr. Porter's 35B motion. And I think this is ripe for appeal right now because we filed a timely appeal to the trial court's order denying the filings that Mr. Porter made with unconflicted counsel, with counsel that was actually defending him and actually doing the job of an advocate and the job which is to respond to false allegations made against Mr. Porter. In most cases, people can say a lot of things in these post-conviction situations, and they may not matter. But in this case, we know that it matters because we know that the trial court highlighted Swebisch's statements in granting Swebisch's 35B motion and then denying Mr. Porter's 35B motion. And when the trial court did that, it did not have the benefit of unconflicted counsel, a truly adversarial process. And that's what Strickland talks about. It talks about, and the Colorado decisions applying the U.S. Supreme Court decision in Strickland, it talks about the breakdown of the adversarial process. That's what we are to guard against. It talks about things like when the advocate is not doing his job. And I'm submitting to the court, if we don't have that here, I mean, we don't even have a potential or perceived conflict of interest. We have an actual undisputed conflict of interest where Mr. Porter's lawyer also represented the co-defendant. And that wasn't just a theoretical conflict of interest. That was a real conflict of interest because co-defendant Swebisch placed himself in an antagonistic position to Mr. Porter, and Mr. Porter had to respond to that. Otherwise, the trial court, in its careful review of motions and issues placed before it, is just going to assume that what Mr. Swebisch was saying was true, and its order reflects that assumption.
Is the conflict waivable?
The conflict can be waived, but it was not waived here.
Well, we haven't heard from Mr. Orris, sir. Isn't that a problem that's not for us right now?
I'm not sure Mr. Orris has a right to, I guess he could have filed briefs with either the trial court or this court if he wanted to, but I don't think that this court should require Mr. Orris or delay a decision until it hears from Mr. Orris. I think the conflict is obvious on its face, and again, it's not contested.
Is there a right even to appeal from a 35B decision?
I believe there is. The 35B is a critical stage of the proceedings, and the 35B, a person has a limited right to a statutory right to counsel, post-conviction counsel in the state of Colorado.
The case law and the rules specifically say, I think, that you can't appeal a 35B if the issue before the appellate court is the propriety of the sentence. Do you disagree with that under the Bush case, which we asked you to be prepared to address?
Yeah. I disagree that that's what Bush says, and I read that case, and I appreciate the court telling us to be prepared for that case. That case held that a trial court has a duty to exercise its judicial discretion, and it has a duty to actually analyze evidence. That's what Bush says. And in this particular case, we don't believe the trial court actually looked at the evidence, and it should have held a hearing, an evidentiary hearing for Mr. Porter, like it did for Mr. Swebisch, and taken testimony, because we had this clash, and the trial court should have held that hearing to resolve that. And we don't think Bush forecloses an appeal on a 35B.
So it's your position that there's an absolute right to a hearing on a 35B motion?
No, we never said that it was an absolute right, Your Honor. We say that on the facts of this particular case, where the 35B is a critical issue, I mean, the critical stage of this case, really, if you look back. Obviously, the plea is knowing and intelligent, and we're not challenging that as part of this appeal. But the fact that Mr. Porter could have gotten a reduction of his sentence because an identically situated co-defendant who pled to the same thing, who had the exact same lack of criminal history, same facts, gets a reduction from 9 to 5 years, and then Mr. Porter is denied that without even a hearing where the trial court can reconcile these things. It's our position that Bush requires the trial court to actually consider the factors and actually consider the evidence to exercise its discretion. And on the facts of this case and on the record, the trial court did not do that.
Mr. Corey, you're at 2.5 minutes, so I thought I'd just
thank you. I thought that might go over, and I appreciate the reminder.
Good afternoon. May it please the court. My name is Susan Friedman. I represent the people in this matter. My attorney number is 34450. It is my position that the defendant does not have a right to appeal the 35B motion itself, that is the propriety of the sentence. The only thing that we could possibly be here for would be to say that he didn't have a hearing on his allegation that his counsel had a conflict. But the remedy, or you know, what he would normally do in this situation, as you mentioned earlier, is file a 35C in the trial court saying, I wasn't properly represented in my 35B because my counsel had an actual conflict, and then that would be litigated. And then if he succeeded in that litigation, the remedy would be to have a new unconflicted counsel appointed and then litigate the 35B, and that's exactly what happened here. So I'm not sure why we're here, because I think the only possible remedy has already occurred in the trial court. And that's something.
When counsel presents a 35B motion, as they did here, is there some kind of implicit indication that counsel is an unconflicted lawyer, or is there anything like that that ordinarily is represented by an attorney filing a CRIMP 35B motion?
I don't know of anything formal, but assuming that a defendant would be entitled to effective assistance of counsel in post-conviction proceedings as a whole, so including 35B, then that would include someone who was not under an actual conflict of interest.
Well, so, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but as I read the record in this case, there was a gentleman by the name of Nicholas Orris that actually made some statements at the sentencing hearing, was there not? Was this the same person?
I don't know that he spoke at the defendant's sentencing hearing. I think he may have spoke at one of the co-defendant's sentencing hearings. And then after everybody was sentenced, this defendant hired him privately to represent him on the 35B, I guess not knowing that he was going to also represent the co-defendant. And then he sort of had that conflict between not wanting to make either of them seem like the culpable one. And that was the sort of basis for the conflict argument, which we haven't had any hearing on, we don't have it fleshed out, but even assuming arguendo, that was a legitimate actual conflict, the remedy has already occurred.
I'm not sure I follow you, Ms. Friedman, on why the remedy's actually already occurred.
Because there was a second attorney appointed, he filed a motion for substitution of counsel.
Right.
Substitute counsel, no conflict, filed a supplemental 35B, and then the order that's attached to my brief is the trial court's order ruling on the supplemental 35B. So he got to relitigate the 35B with an attorney who was not conflicted.
Well, if the court didn't have jurisdiction, then that order's void, isn't it?
That would be a problem, yes. The court had doubts about its jurisdiction, but I think that, there's no mechanism providing for a motion for reconsideration, and that would, unless we find that the court just loses all jurisdiction, usually if it's optional, I think a court can exercise its discretion to reconsider its own order, but if we find that the 120 days had passed and that's it, that's all, the court had no authority, then we're in trouble.
I mean, clearly here, although, the 120 days had passed,
right,
from the time of sentencing to the time of the motion to reconsider the reconsideration.
Yes. Well, so the way that the trial court didn't articulate this, but it almost seems as if the trial court treated this as a 35C, saying, you know, hey, there was a problem with my previous 35B, I had a conflict of counsel, and instead of holding a hearing on that, the court said, well, even assuming that you did have that problem.
Pardon me for interrupting.
Sure.
Ms. Friedman, but Because the trial court didn't make any reference to 35C, and because it was specifically responding to the motion to consider the reconsider the 35B, isn't it kind of a stretch to say that the court was treating it as a 35C?
Well, I think that he raised a 35C claim in the 35B, because ineffective assistance is a 35C claim. It's not saying I should have my sentence reduced because I had ineffective assistance of counsel. It's saying there was a procedural problem and my constitutional rights were violated in this earlier proceeding when I had ineffective assistance of counsel. So it's the substance of the claim. It's properly brought under 35C. It doesn't belong in this motion for reconsideration where it was placed. But my point is that it would be redundant to go back now and litigate it as a 35C, because he has already received the remedy that he would receive were he successful in litigating the 35C. If he were to establish a conflict, the remedy would be a new 35B with unconflicted counsel, and we've done that.
Let's assume for purposes of argument that the trial court didn't have jurisdiction to enter this order, the ultimate order. Mm-hmm. And then let's also assume that again, for purposes of argument, that we get past the Bush and the late filing of the appeal. I'm a little bit concerned about how both parties seem to treat this as a standard Strickland issue, i.e., both subpar performance and prejudice. Isn't this really a Kyler issue, a Kyler versus Sullivan issue? In other words, if that's so, again, assuming for purposes of argument the other things, if that's so, we are not looking at the prejudice prong, right? We presume it if we find that that stuff happened.
That's true. And, yeah, I regret not citing to Mickens. Defense counsel cited to Kyler in the opening brief, mm-hmm. and upon reading it again, I realized that I had sort of gotten off track because Silva involved a conflict of interest and a garden variety ineffective assistance, and I think I just followed the wrong track in that. But this is a conflict of interest, so we would have to show that there was a conflict that adversely affected counsel's performance. And his allegation to that effect is that he failed to, the attorney failed to either bring up mitigation during the 35B or call that to the court's attention, or failed to dispute things that were disparaging to the defendant. That's his claim of how the conflict adversely affected the representation. So I think that's fairly well, I mean, there has been no evidentiary hearing, but I think that would be easy to establish an actual conflict here, which still brings me back to what's the remedy and the fact that we've had the remedy already. So
are you agreeing that there was an actual conflict?
Well, I can't say that without a rule. I mean, it's not my place without a trial court ruling or an evidentiary hearing, but I don't think that would be a difficult thing to prove in this case, given the allegations, if we assume them to be true. That would establish, I think, an actual conflict, because there is an actual something you can point to that this attorney didn't do or did do. And you can link that to the fact that he represented the co-defendant in a similar proceeding. So I think it's actually kind of a classic actual conflict, one of the first ones I've seen in a while. So that may very well may be. And probably to do this procedurally properly, it would be to order it to go back to the trial court and litigate this in the 35C, whether there was an actual conflict.
Well, we can't force somebody to file a new motion.
Well, that's true. I don't know if you could say this, we prefer that this be raised in a 35C, or I'm not really sure actually how to procedurally untangle this. But I do feel as if the relief requested has been granted in this case, and that puts us back in the position of all we're talking about is the actual substance of the 35B, which isn't subject to appeal.
So you're inviting us to assume that there was a conflict, assume that the conflict adversely affected the representation, but nevertheless say the same result would obtain because the trial court specifically said, disregarding the conflict, he now has unconflicted counsel, mm-hmm. I would not change the sentence.
Yes.
You think we can jump through all those procedural hoops? validly?
Sure. Let's see. I do, I think just in the interest of judicial economy, that it can be done. The trial court's order, I don't often attach the orders to my briefs, but I thought it was very thorough, and it seemed as if the trial court did consider everything that was before it, which is why I'm almost inclined to argue that the court treated it as a 35C, because the court made comments about the representation that, you know, it didn't find it to be a problem, but even assuming arguendo that this happened and that the court was misled and everything, you know, the court specifically said it was considering everything anew with new counsel. So I don't see why that doesn't supersede the previous problematic 35C, or B, sorry. So we have a 35B that was constitutionally deficient, and then we have a subsequent, the court's order gives us evidence that there was a subsequent 35B analysis that was very thorough after the court was informed of the alleged conflict and when the defendant was represented by unconflicted counsel. We know that happened, and that's a proper 35B, and so I don't think there's anything here now to appeal. And I'm not sure what he's appealing. I mean, he can only appeal the most recent order, and he seems to only be asking for a hearing, for a new 35B hearing. But the only reason he would be entitled to a new 35B hearing is because he had did not have effective assistance of counsel at the last one, but he did, because we have this one where he was properly represented by someone who didn't have a conflict, and he hasn't alleged any deficiency whatsoever in that second attorney's representation. So I think then we're just back to whether the trial court abused its discretion in not holding an evidentiary hearing on the 35B, either the first one or the second one.
The allegations are pretty serious. As I understand, the allegations are that the court was persuaded to make decisions based on false and therefore fraudulent statements by counsel and the other client in the other matter, and that also was then used, had to be in the judge's head when he was ruling on this issue. Shouldn't there have been some kind of a hearing on when there's charges of that severity?
I'm not sure what you mean by charges.
As I understand, counsel is saying that on the motion to reconsider that was filed by the other, I forget the name of the other defendant, he made a number of false statements about the defendant that's before us now, Mr. Porter, that couldn't help but carry over in the decision making that the judge made in respect to Mr. Porter's motion. Under those circumstances, should there have been a hearing?
I don't think so, because the court addresses that in the order. The court addresses those allegations and just says that they said something about if, in fact, former counsel was prevented by some sort of divide allegiance from emphasizing defendant's assertedly lesser culpability as compared to the others, in parentheses, the court does not find this to be so but assumes it for this discussion. It has been remedied now by new counsel. So the court is acknowledging.
The court is assuming, though, that they're false. And as I understand it, the allegations are that it wasn't just there was some sort of exculpatory stuff, but there were false representations made.
I'm not sure that the court needed to know, for instance, how much money each defendant made, as opposed to knowing that all of them were in it for profit. That was one of the allegations. He didn't make as much money as the other guys, or, you know, he didn't start it. This other guy started it and recruited him in to do it, you know. These are sort of factual allegations that I don't know how much you get to litigate after you plead guilty, and this should be brought up at sentencing. And initially, they all got the same sentence. So I'm not sure what was brought up after the fact, and we can't really compare other defendants to this defendant in the court exercising its discretion. There's so many factors that come in. I don't think you can say that because this defendant over here pointed the finger at another one that the other one gets a new hearing, because that's improper for the court to know about that. I mean, I think we would presume that the court is following the rules.
And the trial judge here is the same in both cases, right?
It does appear that way, yes. And I'm not, I would like to know now the order in which all this happened, who was sentenced first, second, last, and who's hearing. You know, it sounds like the other gentleman got a hearing and this one didn't, and so that's where this perceived unfairness is coming in. But we don't know what the trial court's reason was for holding the hearing or not. And it's not as if statements at a hearing on a motion to reconsider is sworn testimony of some sort that the trial court's bound to then follow in another case. You know, it's just statements to the court. So because I've run out of time, I will simply ask you to either dismiss the appeal or affirm the trial court's order denying the motion for reconsideration of the denial of 35B. Thank you.
I'm going to take my remaining time to respond to a couple of arguments. First of all, hearings matter. Hearings are unique ways of discerning the truth that courts have at their disposal. Even this court grants oral argument in certain cases and not all cases to advance the court's knowledge of what's going on. In this particular case, these are unique facts. This is not a common case that you see in trial courts, and certainly not in this court. A hearing in this case on Mr. Porter's 35B motion would have advanced the trial court's knowledge and given it its ability to comply with the Bush case that this court wanted us to address, which requires, at page 583, the trial court to consider all relevant material factors, including new evidence. And that was the ream of new evidence that new counsel, me, supplied to the trial court.
Is there any evidence, Mr. Corey, that the trial judge didn't consider what you filed? In fact, it looks to me like he did.
He put out a three-page order, but he did not hold a hearing, and he did hold a hearing on the co-defendant Adam Swebisch's 35B motion, in which Swebisch had the opportunity through his counsel to impress these points upon the trial court in the advantageous setting of a live evidentiary hearing.
Very quickly, pardon me for interrupting.
No problem.
Corey, but very quickly, it appears to me that the trial court, when it wrote, if in fact the court does not concede this to be so, but merely assumes it hypothetically for this discussion, that Swebisch and Kramer succeeded in misleading the court as to their degree of culpability to their advantage, that is obviously wrong and regrettable, but it does not bring into question the appropriateness of Porter's sentence. Porter was sentenced based on the facts pertaining to Porter's conduct, many of those facts stipulated to in the statement of plea disposition. Doesn't that tell us that he considered the information that you submitted?
But the trial court left out, when the trial court says, if these two succeeded in swaying the court to their advantage, that's regrettable, the trial court should have said, and to Mr. Porter's disadvantage, and that is the actual import of this. In the trial court record.
Doesn't the court say that Swebisch and Kramer dishonestly threw the blame onto Porter, leading the court to give him a longer sentence than deserved? Doesn't that mean that he considered what you gave him?
But the trial court did not modify the 9-year sentence, and that's what we are seeking the court to consider in the context of an evidentiary hearing. We want the trial court to look at the complicated evidence in this case and the lengthy multi-page brief filed by Swebisch, and he got his evidentiary hearing on that brief, and Mr. Porter was even denied a hearing. We understand that this court is not going to second-guess trial court discretionary sentencing, not going to say 7 years is okay, 9 years is not okay. We understand that. All we are asking for is the hearing so the trial court can properly exercise its jurisdiction, and it's our argument on the unique facts of this case that are unlike any other case. On these unique facts, a hearing could have allowed the trial court to exercise its discretion, not arbitrarily and not capriciously, and that's what we're asking in this appeal, and it's timely. Thank you for considering these arguments.
Thank you both for your arguments this afternoon. The case will stand submitted. We'll get a written opinion to you in due course. That concludes the docket for this afternoon. We'll be in recess. The bailiff needs someone else.
The court will be in recess, so we need to call.